Hello and welcome to Fast and Fair, the Climate Transition Podcast. I'm Lee Beck, an international director at the Clean Air Task Force. We're a climate NGO focusing on innovation and advanced decarbonization technologies such as methane. Shout out to our methane team for helping ratchet up global ambition and pulling together more than 100 countries for the Global Methane Pledge on Tuesday, as well as carbon capture, hydrogen, geothermal, and other technologies. I'm subbing today for Paul Fancil, co-founder of The Conduit, a diverse community of people passionate about positive impact. This episode is produced in collaboration with DLA Piper and recorded at The Conduit Studio here at COP26 as part of a series exploring the role of law in responding to climate change. Throughout this series, we're speaking to experts on climate justice and litigation, policymaking, human rights, finance, and carbon literacy to understand how business, government, and the third sector can work together to speed up the transition to a just and sustainable future. My guest today is Andreas Gunst, a climate change and energy regulatory and finance attorney and a partner at DLA Piper. Andreas is a member of DLA Piper's SESG steering committee. He also started his work in carbon markets in 2006 in climate change capital and has advised on a wide variety of emissions reductions and renewable energy projects since then. He also acted as counsel to the several industry organizations such as the European Federation of Energy Traders, the Carbon Markets and Investors Association, and REX International on standard documentation for the trading of emissions allowances, renewable energy certificates, and offsets. Andreas is currently working on a number of carbon capture and storage and use projects in the UK and Europe, and the certification, trading, and recognition of green hydrogen. Welcome, Andreas. It's such an honor to have you here. So you joined me today to talk about some of my favorite topics, hydrogen and carbon capture and storage technologies in decarbonizing the energy and industrial sectors. Both of them are a vital element on the path for net zero. And the buzz about both of them is really picking up speed, incredible speed, especially here at COP26. So tell me a little bit, why should we be particularly excited about carbon capture and hydrogen potential to decarbonize industry and energy at this point in history?
Yeah, thanks very much for having me. And it's sort of equally exciting to talk with you about that. So I think, looking back a few years, in fact, my first carbon capture and storage project has been here in the UK, in and about sort of 2009, 2008, with the Power Fuels project then, which was sort of a Corbett methane project with carbon capture and storage, one that had originally funding from the EU Commission. I think it's been sort of a long way coming, and obviously with the dip in the carbon markets in the early 2010s, obviously we sort of unfortunately had a period where actually this technology, which was always dubbed to be a very, very important part of the overall picture of reducing CO2 and actually sort of links into so many different abatement possibilities, just didn't get off the ground. And it's really encouraging to see that especially here in the UK, where we now have a number of cluster projects. We're working one at the moment, Humber and Teesside, but also in many other countries, especially in Europe, a number of port-related projects. Antwerp is one of them. Germany has a number as well. And nearly every country is sort of looking into carbon capture and storage at the moment. So it's the right message. It just feels like the right message, the right time at the moment. As I said, in the combination with hydrogen, that's why it's now carbon capture and utilization or use and storage projects. It's just a really great technology opening up a lot of different possibilities also for hydrogen.
Yeah, fantastic. You just mentioned it, deep decarbonization hubs. The UK is a leader. Indeed, UK Committee on Climate Change told us carbon capture is not an option. It's a necessity for net zero. But you also touched on hydrogen. So how is this related? What's the role of carbon capture in producing hydrogen? What are our options to produce hydrogen, perhaps? And also, how can they help decarbonize these industrial clusters, help safeguard jobs? Would love to drill a little bit deeper into those questions.
Yeah, I mean, we just talked about one of the clusters here in the UK, and I think it's a good example to show how really the different areas of power production, also, you know, energy intensive or carbon intensive production, coupled with carbon capture and storage, and also, you know, the potential of utilizing blue hydrogen or even green hydrogen in the process actually brings it all together. It's that possibility to either, where you have the need to actually add carbon to the production of a product, for instance, in order, for instance, to create a synthetic fuel and take sort of hydrogen, you know, further than it's just possible at the moment with a pipeline. It's just a very good combination, secondly, also for the possibility to decarbonize for the development of green hydrogen, and bringing it in a cluster. And I think, you know, everybody sort of looking at these cluster projects at the moment is just a very, very good opportunity to, you know, combine the respective strength of the different technologies and areas.
Yeah, fantastic. So I think there's a lot of projects on the horizon. We said carbon capture projects, I think more than around 45 in Europe, including the UK, many more in hydrogen, green, and blue hydrogen, of course. So what is really needed to in terms of infrastructure investments and or in general in terms of infrastructure to really scale these technologies, to commercialize these technologies?
It's as always, when you try to develop a new area, and in fact, you know, we've talked about this at the start of the podcast. It's been coming for a long time. In the area of carbon capture and storage, you need to create the right business case for it. And I think this is still where, you know, especially some countries are still scratching their heads around, okay, how do you actually sufficiently incentivize private sector investment into these projects? Clearly, there needs to be a regulatory framework around it that sort of determines how you would use these networks, how you get access to these networks, how you fund the networks, but the sort of little, you know, bits in the overall jigsaw, if you like, of that overall cluster idea, which is still quite uncertain at the moment. One of them usually is the question of, how do you actually value the use of that infrastructure, where the carbon price definitely is moving up and down. So. Sort of unlike other, you know, pipeline-based infrastructures like gas, for instance, you know, because it doesn't, CO2 as such doesn't have a value, it's an environmental liability. How do you value that, and how you therefore sort of set the pricing? Or does it just need to be an entirely different pricing model for these types of infrastructure? Another area that also sort of frequently comes up is just the question around who actually's got the responsibility and the liability. We have an EU emissions trading scheme, we've got a UK emissions trading scheme. All of those are effectively installation focused. So the ones that have the regulatory obligation are the installations. Now, that doesn't quite sort of match up with the idea of, you know, an infrastructure where it's being transported, where it's being stored. Clearly, there are some ideas about, and especially the UK has gone quite a long way in terms of determining what that long-term liability would be and how that might transfer also to the state. But there's still that sort of interaction between the concept of installation-based commitments and liability versus how does it all work once sort of an installation gives that to a pipeline, gives that to storage. That still needs to be fine-tuned and clarified. But all of those are elements that clearly, you know, have been thought about in the past, but it's just a matter of now proving the concept, if you like, in these cluster projects and showing how you bring it all together in terms of a commercial structure.
Yeah, fantastic. So many things that I want to talk about with you today in what you were describing. So maybe, are there any specific cluster of projects in the carbon capture and hydrogen space that you would describe as specific success examples or that you're personally really excited about?
Yeah, that's a really good question, actually. I'm actually very excited about all of the projects we're working on. And they are really quite different in structure. You know, some of them are really sort of very, closed clusters. Some of them are actually really thinking about, using existing infrastructure, trying to ship instead of trying to transport via pipeline. So there's loads of different, and this is really what why one can be excited about different projects at the moment. There are so many different approaches to trying to make carbon capture, storage, and use possible, but also workable, and the way in which that can be commercialized. So I think I wouldn't want to single out one project. I think, as I said, sort of Humber and Teesside, which have been selected among the first clusters in the UK, is a very good one to look at, and certainly one that I think will produce a lot of good experience. There's also other projects. I mentioned Germany before, sort of Belgium with Antwerp, and a few other sort of port-based projects that are really, really interesting, really exciting. Equally, I think there are a few projects that are really quite interesting from a regulatory angle. I think Germany, as you may know, sort of introduced an incentive mechanism under the German renewables subsidy regime, the EEG, where there's a sort of a process around how with coupled guarantees of origin, you actually can demonstrate green hydrogen. That obviously is more on the hydrogen side, but it sort of plays also equally into the question of how you commercialize and how you combine carbon capture and storage with hydrogen production in those clusters, and how you need to set up the overall contractual structure to make that work and to really demonstrate, the underlying production method, and therefore the question of whether it's blue hydrogen, green hydrogen, or similar.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, so many things. I think one area that I do want to highlight here, as you touched upon, is the versatility of carbon capture and hydrogen. They're really carbon capture can help us produce the clean energy vector hydrogen. It can also help us reduce process emissions directly from industrial sectors. Steel and cement is one example. It's actually the main road to decarbonize cement. Carbon capture and hydrogen form the main two pathways to decarbonize steel production, but there's also opportunities in the power sector, negative emissions. So really, there's not just one project that we can single out, because it really comes down to a versatility of sectors that we can, or diversity of sectors that we can decarbonize with these technologies. So you touched on the EEG and hydrogen certification. From my perspective, the EEG is actually one of the most successful innovation policies globally, because of course it helped us to commercialize solar and made available solar at lower cost. So I'd love to hear your perspective. Are there any policy initiatives that you think are extremely promising in Europe or the UK to help us commercialize these projects or these technologies, not just having a couple of demonstration projects, but really building multiple hydrogen facilities, multiple carbon capture facilities?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we're sort of, when you look at it, European, UK, and also sort of global scale, if you like, there's lots of different approaches at the moment to supporting these projects. I think the key always is that you find a structure where you can over time integrate that commercial structure into the general market. And for me, that always means you should be able to, adjust it, but also align it to the carbon pricing mechanisms that you've got in that country. You also align it to, where it's sort of related to an additional commodity like hydrogen, that you do achieve a sort of a market price, but maybe with a sort of a top up in form of a premium CFD type mechanism. I think what is absolutely essential is that we find an adequate way of certifying the production method of hydrogen in particular. There's obviously loads of different certification possibilities at the moment. There's HISA, there's guarantees of origin based. There are other certificate schemes like IREX. There are also underlying schemes, for instance, the methane intensity type certificates that MIQ have just sort of created, which are also helping in terms of blue hydrogen to show content. But sort of bringing all of these policies together, I think, is quite critical. And I think very often there's still a little bit missing around actually how you, how can you be sure when you, you know, produce something that is meant to be green hydrogen, that it will be accepted as green hydrogen in a different market, because there is no overall requirement at the moment that would actually set out, you know, under what circumstances something that that has used, for instance, renewable source electricity or has used gas, but with carbon capture and storage is, you know, is green hydrogen as blue hydrogen respectively. And here there's still a disconnect between how that certification, which is so fundamentally important commercially, is actually priced versus sort of the underlying production methods. It's as much as I like the HiCert scheme, I think the difficulty with this really, it does require a much more robust framework at the moment around how green hydrogen, how blue hydrogen is actually accepted as such in the market. At the moment, it's sort of based on a unilateral acceptance, but you know that's for a lot of these projects not sufficient to make, you know, 15-year, 20-year type investments, and you need more certainty around the actual acceptance of those standards, and that's what's I think going to be really key in terms of, you know, driving this market and making sure people can invest long term because they know it's going to be accepted as green hydrogen.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you're touching on a really important topic here in the hydrogen debate, blue versus green. What is the role of either? From our perspective at the Clean Air Task Force, we, of course, see the potential of blue that can be unleashed really quickly, requires upstream methane mitigation, and, of course, very good certification standards that you suggested. Green is promising in the future, but really both have a role to play. And I'd love to see, you know, what do you think about it? Do you see one or the other, both? And how quickly can we scale them, you think?
Time always shows, and certainly with renewables, that you sort of think you've got a, you've got a particular view around how quickly you can commercialize something. And once you put people to the task, it tends to be faster. So that's in some way promising for the actual ability to utilize green hydrogen. But it's a little bit like certification also in the renewables market, if I can draw that comparison. We have a lot of corporate PPAs in the market, and they've been extremely successful. But when you look at corporate PPAs, you're actually not necessarily matching supply to demand in the way that, you know, in every settlement period, you know, your consumption sort of equals the supply in every half hour or hourly period. But you average it out over the year. With, you know, monthly issued guarantees of origin or REGOs, which have a megawatt hour denomination. So there's always going to be, you know, a difference between when you consume and when you produce. And if you were very, dogmatic about it in a way, you would obviously want, and you can see that concept for 27-type corporate PPAs, you would want to match your consumption with the production. But if you were to do that, you wouldn't have enough projects to actually meet the demand of corporates for corporate PPAs. And so you would almost, if you were to introduce that concept overnight, make it extremely difficult for corporates to do corporate PPAs, and thereby you would suddenly lose all the voluntary interest that's there at the moment, which is fundamentally driven by obviously voluntary initiatives rather than, you know, a particular benefit from a levy reduction or tax exemption or something similar. So, and it's the same way with green hydrogen and blue hydrogen. If you want to create the demand, I think that there will it's inevitable that you need to have blue hydrogen, which, as you rightly said, can be scaled much more quickly than green hydrogen. And it sort of enables for the demand to be created that then helps to actually scale up green hydrogen. And if you again were sort of very dogmatic about green hydrogen in the same way you would be very dogmatic about 24/7 corporate PPAs, you would sort of kill off that demand development quite quickly because people just couldn't do it in a reasonable sort of time period in which they're sort of willing to invest or take actions. And so I think it's really important that both are combined. Clearly, I think it's fair to say that, you know, all else being equal, people would like to see, you know, more green hydrogen faster than blue hydrogen. But realistically, if you want to create that very essential demand, you do need blue hydrogen for that in order to develop that. And for in carbon capture use and storage, it's absolutely essential.
Yeah, absolutely. Totally agree with you. This was also a great explanation, I thought. So from a decarbonization perspective in Europe, especially hydrogen production, carbon capture and storage, do you see first movers, some countries that are more on the forefront, say like the UK or Norway? And also, do you see a role for imports on hydrogen in particular, say blue hydrogen imports from the Middle East, green hydrogen imports globally? This has been really intensely discussed here at COP, so would love to see your perspective on how this global hydrogen market, like global fuels market is developing.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, definitely, again, it's a sort of very discussion that we just had around, you know, developing markets. And I think it's when you look at the possibility to scale up in Europe, it's certain that you probably will have to have hydrogen imports. And, you know, I'm a lawyer, I'm not an economist, but sort of looking at the projections that most people have around how you scale it up and where the sweet spot is for it, I think it's probably fair to say that you can't, or at least what I read from the various charts and studies is that you can't really do it without a significant amount of import. And that then raises again the question that we were just discussing around how do you actually demonstrate that what's been produced is actually blue hydrogen, carbon capture and storage, or it's green hydrogen, right? How do you do that? And how does that also align to other policy initiatives, for instance, like the, you know, like the CBAM, where obviously not directly related to the import of hydrogen, but if you were to use hydrogen rails in a production process, then it's indirectly, again, sort of relevant for products that are being imported. But the certification piece for me is the sort of the real key, and we've not quite found an answer to that yet, because you're only ever going to invest long term in either carbon capture use and storage in any exporting country, or in fact in green hydrogen production, if you know that your product will be accepted as green hydrogen. And again, sort of using that example that we discussed earlier, Germany with the idea of a couple of GOOs, it's a very, very good idea in terms of basically demonstrating in a very strict way that electricity from renewable sources has been produced in production. Therefore, you couple your GOOs with your electricity supply. But that actually makes it extremely difficult for things like green hydrogen coming from out of the EU, or even, you know, within the EU, to be fair, then to be sort of imported to actually make that possible. Because, you know, in Europe, you can't quite make what's currently the exemption possible on the basis of market coupling. If you were to have wind generation somewhere else, that will make it difficult, and the same for imported hydrogen. So it's that sort of piece of, you know, getting it right between the understandable interest on the regulatory side to say, first of all, I want to have certainty that it really is green hydrogen. So I need to have something that's perhaps certificates in addition to or coupled with some form of mass balancing or, you know, notional path for these to really be demonstrated that it is green hydrogen in its production, but at the same time also allow a level playing field where, you know, this is being produced in other countries and then brought in, and having the certainty that, that it actually has been produced in a similar way, and you're not putting green hydrogen development in the respective European market at a disadvantage. And that's where, again, we're sort of always coming back to that certification point, but that's where really there is an important piece in the jigsaw missing at the moment, which is being worked on, but you need to have that in order to bring that all together.
Okay, let's take this point of certification and go from the supply side of decarbonization, clean hydrogen production, carbon capture and storage, to the demand side. There have been a lot of discussions around the CBAM, of course, carbon intensity of products. There was a new trade agreement announced this weekend. U.S. and Europe are going to create a platform to negotiate a framework based on the carbon intensity of steel and aluminum. The President Biden also announced the First Movers Coalition, a private sector buyers club for low carbon products, cement, steel, aluminum, direct air capture. If we're shifting a little bit to the demand side, how important do you think these demand side policies and initiatives are to creating demand for low carbon products that are produced with clean hydrogen or low carbon hydrogen with carbon capture and storage as a decarbonization technology?
I think there's sort of a few elements there that are really driving the debate. And obviously purely from a customer perspective, you clearly want to make sure that you get the best product at the lowest price. And so from that perspective, I think this is a sort of combination of how can you be certain and how do you actually value as a customer the carbon content of the product that you're buying, and is that is there enough sort of voluntary commitment or does that need to be shaped in some form of industrial policy around certain rebates, tax exemptions, etc., to really help to create that demand or sort of nudge, if you like, customers on the point of actually pricing the carbon element into their consideration when they buy products. And I think that's one element. The other element is really that sort of level playing field discussion that we still have with CBAM. That's also really driving the CBAM around. Okay, how do you create a level playing field where for some products that have been created in a jurisdiction that has a carbon pricing mechanism, form of an ETS or similar, and products coming from another, how is that comparable? And I think even certainly, even though, and I find this a really, really, CBAM a very fascinating topic, because CBAM is in development. It's not, it's not policy, it's not law yet. But it's amazing how much that regulation already drives considerations that we see on the client side to say, well, actually, I need to position myself, and it's quite difficult because I don't quite understand how I could, for instance, make a corporate PPA work in the context of CBAM, because it doesn't really consider that sort of element or the certification elements. It's sort of in there indirectly, but it's not very express, and that is actually sort of making it quite difficult. I know that's sort of the supply side as well, but from a car producer, for instance, that's sort of looking at buying green steel or green aluminium. I think it's exactly that point. How do I measure from the producer what is actually being done on the carbon side, and is that sort of do I just rely on the CBAM mechanism? Do I want to have actually something, or does the CBAM sort of need to align to how we do that at the moment, which is sort of more around the corporate PPAs, certifications around IREX, other types of certificates? How do you bring that together? So there's a piece where you've got a good concept, and it's already, although it's not even law, it's already really driving investments and considerations and structuring of transactions. But that is very much focused on measuring sort of carbon content in a way that doesn't really make it very clear how you can reduce it, right? How can you abate? And it especially for the evolving legislative framework of the CBAM, it will be very important to also expressly consider things like corporate PPAs, like certificates in the overall context of that. And that will then in itself, again, help to create the demand, because people then realize, okay, if I my producer, I have these requirements in terms of what you need to demonstrate to me in order for your product to be green. And I don't necessarily just need to rely on the concept of the CBAM, which is just for leveling the playing field of competitors, rather than sort of looking at also from the perspective of the customer and helping the customer to make informed choices. And again, that's a sort of a key element that needs to be considered.
Great. Yeah, I mean, absolutely agree. Certification is really the road towards incentivizing these technologies and also market creation. I think there's a big debate right now also in the negative emission space. Some of the clusters in the UK are aiming for negative emissions. There's direct air capture on the horizon. Any thoughts on this kind of next generation of technology as the part of the carbon capture, removal and storage value chain?
Yeah, I agree. Sort of very promising, very exciting developments. Again, I think they have the same issues, at least sort of fundamentally, as they stand at the moment with the technologies that are already in play around actually, you know, trying to figure out how they commercially fit into the picture. But very exciting, and certainly, the whole discussion around negative emissions really important also in the context of looking at the overall process in the clusters holistically and figuring out what is the right driver here commercially, but also from a policy perspective.
Absolutely agree. I mean, the International Energy Agency has shown that 75% of emissions reductions are expected to come from technologies that are not yet mature, that includes renewables, but also, as we touched upon, hydrogen and carbon capture. However, these technologies remain controversial. And that's, I think, from my perspective, also why they perhaps, in addition to policy flip-flopping, lack of government commitment, and an overall ignorance towards decarbonizing the industrial sector over the past decade, have not been commercialized. What's your perspective on some of the controversies that are out there about advanced energy technologies in general?
Let me try to use an example to explain that a little bit better. I'm really, really excited about the commitment that was made a few days ago around the methane pledge and the methane coalition, and sort of making sure, because methane is a very potent greenhouse gas, and in fact, if you have too much methane emission in the production process, is actually more harmful than coal. But I was also thinking that, hang on, more than a decade ago, and probably sort of 12, 13 years ago, I was actually working on, projects, then, JI projects and CDM projects to sort of patch up pipelines that were leaky, right? And it sometimes sort of feels like, when you're on the motorway, and you're changing the lane because the other lane seems to be moving faster, and you switch the lane, and then, 10 minutes later, you realized had you stayed in the lane, you would have been further ahead. And it's a little bit like that with this discussion as well, because I think you need to have a certain pragmatism. Of course, you can be dogmatic about a particular policy and the use and whether it will really result into the reduction, or whether there is a better mechanism that is in terms of sort of its purest form of reducing emissions better, and But we're always sort of forgetting that actually we're already on the path, and if we, you know, if we continued on that path, we would actually get somewhere as well. So you know, switching lanes too often is sometimes not helpful. And I think this is what I'm sometimes worried about in that debate. Certainly, you know, had we continued the projects that we were doing 13 years ago, I think some of the necessity that was expressed around doing projects like these now, because it's very important, methane is a very potent greenhouse gas, would perhaps not be there had we sort of continued on that road. It's a simplification. There have been other issues why we obviously couldn't continue on a CDM and GI basis, but you know, it's important. You can die in beauty, and certainly a degree of pragmatism around new technologies, but also transition technologies like, you know, blue hydrogen, or perhaps not getting it quite right the first time. But you're getting somewhere on the basis of that experience, you can then take the next step is equally important. So pragmatism, even though it might still lead to regulatory change and mean that you haven't found the most perfect solution first time around, is I think still quite important in making the change.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree anymore. As a pragmatic NGO, obviously, from our perspective, IPCC in 2018 made it very clear, the sooner we can reduce emissions, the better our chance at fending off the worst effects of climate change. Of course, all technologies must be on the table to enable each region, country to decarbonize with a technology portfolio that suits individual, local, social, and economic circumstances. And so, yeah, definitely pragmatism is really important, especially as we know it takes 20 to 30 years to commercialize next generation technologies. You touched on the methane pledge. I said earlier, my colleagues from the methane team helped ratchet up global ambition, align more than 100 countries for this really landmark agreement. And of course, it's also really fantastic because this is one of the most important steps governments can take to shave off warming, right? So I'll invite you, Andreas, to join us at the Methane Moment. That's our pavilion in the Blue Zone. And of course, everyone else who's watching. What are some other really exciting announcements here at COP26 that you just think are really pivotal for our road to net zero emissions?
Yeah, again, I probably struggle to single one or a few out. I think you know, every sort of commitment and every proposal that is being made helps, and certainly you know, put forward with the right intention. This is not necessarily government policy, but what excites me also is you know, and just going back to the methane pledge. That you do not only have countries sort of, you know, making a pledge in that regard, but we also now have you know, customers who, in a very, very short time span, have really said, okay, well let's look at the overall production and supply chain of that methane, and let's sort of drill down into how we can actually certify the methane intensity of that, because what you clearly always need is for every good policy and every good pledge, you need to have a process or a technology that allows you to meet that pledge, right? And so I'm very excited about MIQ's certification system that really sort of looks at methane intensities and supply chains to make, you know, to help make that pledge actually work, because it ultimately you need to have somebody to do it, and it will be the companies that either buy or sell methane or operate pipelines that would need to do it, and you need to give them a tool to measure and to identify how they do it. And I think that certainly helps. There's loads of others as well. Obviously, I don't really want to single out, because everything is really off help, and we're sort of at the position where, you know, you want every help that you can get. But it's things like this that really sort of excite me, because you can then see it isn't just a pledge, but that there's actually a tool to make it work. And that's really important.
Yeah, this has been a really fantastic conversation with you, Andreas. Unfortunately, we have to come to the end soon here, but I do want to ask you one last question, which I think is really important. It touches on everything that we've discussed today. We started off with deep decarbonization hubs, co-location of hydrogen and carbon capture. Tell me, if you had to tell someone, okay, from COP26 to COP27, here's the key steps that we need to make this reality, but also perhaps to 2030, what do you think are the most important aspects to really enable deployment and commercialization, really, of carbon capture and storage technologies, hydrogen technologies, negative emissions technologies? And then, of course, overall, these are not just the only climate solutions we have, but overall, what do you think are the most important next steps for climate if you had to close out our conversation today?
I think it's making on the governmental side enough resource available to really give the support in those markets. I think what we still often see is that there are lots of good policies, lots of good ideas, but the ability to help implement that also from the governmental side is not as quickly developing as one would like to see in order to really help. And there are noticeable exceptions to that, but on par, I think it's good because people need to do it, and it's that sort of capacity building, and it's not just government, but it's also generally the capacity building to have people there to do it. And I think we had a very fascinating lunch with business leaders on the Monday. And one of the things that really came out very strongly is, in fact, if you wanted to do all of these, wanted to implement all of these policies, do we actually have the people to do it, the skilled people to do it? Because that seems to be a very big issue, certainly, and especially in Europe, countries with aging populations, do we have enough people to implement it? Tricky, and this is where I think probably sort of when you look at the root cause of some of the delay, you realize it isn't necessarily because there isn't enough financial support, it isn't enough policy support, it isn't enough commitment from corporates, but it's actually that capacity building lags behind, and that is quite essential.
Thank you so much. This has just been really an really insightful, exciting conversation here at COP26 with you, Andreas. My personal key takeaways are we need to be pragmatic. All technologies must be on the table. We need to make sure that they're actually delivering cumulative emissions reductions, so certification mechanisms, as you suggested. We need to plug the skills gap. Really, really important mention that you made here at the end, because and it shouldn't be overlooked. We really need to enable a just transition and need to make sure that we can actually build all the clean energy infrastructure that we need to build between now and 2050. And then, of course, last but not least, we need government buy-in. We need policy certainty, government policy and government funding, so businesses can implement these technology solutions, carbon capture and hydrogen, and also, of course, as we discussed, reduce methane as soon as possible. Thank you so much for joining me here in the Climate Hub today, and we're looking forward to next episode.
Thank you so much. Very nicely summed up. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode produced in partnership with DLA Piper. Feel free to subscribe, rate, and review. This podcast is available on all major podcast platforms on the Conduit Conversations channel. For more information on the Conduit and our community of changemakers, please visit theconduit.com. DLA Piper is committed to making businesses better by helping clients and communities transition to and thrive in a more sustainable future. To find out more, please visit dlapiper.com/SESG. DLA Piper is committed to making businesses better by helping clients and communities transition to and thrive in a more sustainable future. To find out more, please visit dlapiper.com/SESG.